plastic bag of severed hands in the anatomy department, in various stages of dissection, from which I like to make elaborate coloured drawings in imitation of Vesalius. In 1979, I emerged onto the wards of the hospital, where I had trained wearing the long white coat of a junior doctor, as opposed to the short white coat of a medical student. I felt very important. Other hospitals, I later noticed to my confusion, had the medical students in long white coats and the junior doctors in short ones. Like a badge of office, I proudly carried a pager, known colloquially as a bleep, in the breast pocket with a stethoscope, a tourniquet for blood taking, and a drug formulary in the side pockets. Once you had qualified from medical school, you spent a year as a junior house officer, a sort of general dog's body, with 6 months working in surgery and 6 months in medicine. If you wanted a career in hospital medicine as a surgeon or physician, as opposed to becoming a GP, you tried to get a house job in the teaching hospital where you had trained as a student, so as to make yourself known to the senior doctors, on whose patronage your career entirely depended. I wanted to be a surgeon. At least I thought I did, so I managed to get a job on a surgical firm, as it was called, in my teaching hospital. The firm consisted of a consultant, a senior registrar, and a junior registrar, and the houseman. I worked one in two, which meant I did a normal working day 5 days a week, but also was on call every other night and every other weekend. So I was in the hospital for about 120 hours a week. My predecessor had handed me over the bleep with a few words of advice about how to keep the boss happy and how to help the patients who were dying, neither subject being dealt with in the lectures and textbooks. I enjoyed the feeling of power and importance the long hours gave me. In reality, I had little responsibility. The days and nights were spent clerking in patients, taking blood, filling up forms, and chasing up missing X-rays. I usually got just enough sleep, and I became used to being disturbed at night. Occasionally, I assisted in theatre, which meant long hours standing still, holding patients' abdomens open with retractors while my seniors rummaged about. Looking back now, 30 years later, my sense of my own importance at that time seems quite laughable. Much as I liked being part of the small army of junior doctors in the hospital, as the months as a surgical houseman passed, I became increasingly uncertain as to what I was going to do with my medical career. The reality of surgery had proved quite different from my superficial impressions of it when a theatre porter. Surgery seemed to involve unpleasant smelly body parts, sphincters and bodily fluids that I found almost as unattractive as some of the surgeons dealing with them. Although there were a few surgical teachers in the hospital, without whose influence I would never have become a surgeon. It was their kindness to patients, as much as their technical skill, which I found inspiring. I saw no neurosurgery as a medical student or houseman. The neurosurgical operating theatre was out of bounds, and people spoke of it with awe, almost alarm. My next 6 months as a houseman were in a dilapidated old hospital in South London. The building had housed a workhouse in the 19th century, and it was said it had not yet escaped its dismal previous reputation with the local population. It was the sort of hospital which made the British public's devotion to the NHS quite incomprehensible, with the patients housed like cattle in the old workhouse rooms, large and ugly rooms with dozens of beds lined up on either side. The casualty department was on the ground floor, and the intensive care unit on the first floor immediately above it. But there was only one lift in the hospital, which was 1/4 mile away down the main hospital corridor. If a patient had to be transferred urgently from casualty to the ITU, it was the task of the junior houseman on call, with the help of a porter, to push the patient's bed all the way down the corridor from one end of the hospital to the other, take the lift, and then push the patient and bed all the way back again. I tried to do this as quickly as possible, pushing people in the corridor out of the way and commandeering the large and rattling old lift, creating a sense of drama and urgency. I doubt if it was clinically necessary, but it was how it was done on TV and was good fun. Even though I got little sleep at night, there was a doctor's mess and bar run by a friendly Spanish lady who would cook me a meal at any time of night. There was even a lawn outside the main building where I would play croquet with my fellow junior doctors when we had the time. It was busy work, with more responsibility than my first job as a house surgeon, and with much less supervision. I learnt a lot of practical medicine very quickly, but they were not always enjoyable lessons. I was at the bottom of a little hierarchy in the firm. My job was to see all the patients, most of whom were admitted as emergencies through the casualty department, when they arrived, and to look after the ones already on the wards. I learnt very quickly that I did not ring up my seniors about a patient without having first seen the patient myself. I had done this on my first night on call, asking my registrar's advice in advance of going to see a patient the nurses had called me about, and received a torrent of abuse in reply. So, anxious and inexperienced, I would see all the patients, try to decide what to do, and only dare to ring my seniors up if I was really very uncertain indeed. One night, shortly after I had started, I was called in the early hours to see a middle-aged man on the ward who had become breathless, a common enough problem on a busy emergency medical ward. I got out of bed and pulled on my white coat. I slept with my clothes on, since one rarely got more than an hour or two of sleep without being called to casualty or the wards. I walked onto the long and darkened Nightingale ward with its 20 beds on either side facing each other. Restless, snoring, shifting shapes lay in them. Two nurses sat at a desk in the middle of the room, a little pool of light in the darkness, doing paperwork. They pointed to the patient they wanted me to see. "He came in yesterday with a query MI," one of them said, MI being short for a myocardial infarct or heart attack. The man was sitting upright in his bed. He looked terrified. His pulse was fast and he was breathing quickly. I put my stethoscope to his chest and listened to his heart and breath sounds. I ran an ECG, an electrocardiogram which shows the heart's rhythm. It seemed normal enough to me, so I reassured him and told him that there was nothing seriously wrong with his heart. "There's something the matter, Doc," he said. "I know there is. Everything's all right. You're just anxious," I said a little impatiently, keen to get back to bed. He looked despairingly at me as I turned away. I can still hear his laboured breathing now, a sound following me like an accusation as I walked away between the rows of beds with their huddled, restless shapes. I can still hear the way in which, as I reached the doors of the ward, his breathing abruptly stopped, and the ward was suddenly silent. I raced back to the bed, panic-struck, to find him slumped in his bed. "Put out a crash call!" I shouted to the nurses as I started to pound his chest. After a few minutes, my colleagues tumbled bleary-eyed onto the ward, and we spent half an hour failing to get his heart going again. My registrar looked at the earlier ECG trace. "Looks like there were runs of VTAC," he said disapprovingly. "Didn't you notice that? You should have rung me." I said nothing in reply. It used to be called angor animi, the anguish of the soul. The feeling that some people have when they are having a heart attack, that they are about to die. Even now, more than 30 years later, I can see very clearly the dying man's despairing expression as he looked at me as I turned away. There was a slightly grim, exhilarating intensity to the work, and I quickly lost the simple altruism I had had as a medical student. It had been easy then to feel sympathy for patients because I was not responsible for what happened to them. But with responsibility comes fear of failure, and patience become a source of anxiety and stress, as well as occasional pride in success. I dealt with death on a daily basis, often in the form of attempted resuscitation and sometimes with patients bleeding to death from internal hemorrhage. The reality of cardiopulmonary resuscitation is very different from what is shown on TV.